Accession number 13253, Jim Forrest, reel 5.
Well, we had picked out this particular draft series of draft boards because they were so providentially easy to you could take out not just one draft board but 9 draft boards at the same time, and that would in effect close down the Selective Service in one major American city. Well, this was a much more significant event, and that's in a practical sense, than the Catonsville 9, which had taken a handful of papers from one small draft board in the suburb of Baltimore, Maryland. It just seemed an apple that had to be plucked from the tree, you see, you put it that way. We prepared very carefully for the action, and it worked. We were... That evening, that we were on national television, that NBC News had an exclusive. They didn't know what they were going to photograph, but we'd gotten somebody who had been convinced that something was going to be happening worth having a television camera nearby for, and had brought a certain person had been able to bring this person to the site, and that it was filmed as it happened, as these draft files were being burned, and as we were having our prayer service around it. Well. Probably that night, something like 80 or 100 million Americans saw us burning draft records and saw a group of people, mostly priests in their clerical garments, standing around a big fire of draft records. Well, this was quite an event. We were in prison for a month. Finally, we were able to get bail lowered to a level where we could raise the funds that were needed to be bailed out. And we had something in the neighborhood of a half a year or 6 or 8 months when between being bailed out and going on trial, which somebody like myself, and it was true for all of us, I think all 14 of us were just going all over the country speaking for all those months, telling people what we had done and why we did it. Because it was certainly not, we were going to plead not guilty, but it was obvious that we'd done what we'd done. And the only thing we could say is, when is it legal to drive through a red light? Is essentially the point you're trying to communicate. Most of the time, you're risking your life and other people's lives to drive through a red light. But if you have somebody bleeding to death in the back seat of the car, you'll honk your horn and you'll fly through that red light and hope that you can get to the hospital in time to save this person's life. We have, I think in all legal systems, is something similar, a principle of justifiability, that certain actions are justifiable under certain circumstances. And so what we had to show, tried to show, was that it was justifiable to impede the operations of the Selective Service System because it was involved in committing a crime, and that we were trying to make it more, at least in one case, to prevent this crime from being committed, essentially. And we tried to prove this from a religious point of view and from a legal point of view. And indeed, there's a great deal to be said for legal objections to most wars. We were very, very lucky that in the state trial, there were two trials. There was a state trial and a federal trial. The judge who had come out of retirement was a very sweet man who was more than willing, although oftentimes without the jury being present, to have certain arguments presented in court that we wished to present, even though we would have rather presented them to the jury. At least they were heard by the people in the courtroom and by the judge. Mind you, all these things being reported sometimes very extensively in the national press on a daily basis. There were many front page stories in the New York Times during this trial. There was a long account of the trial, filling up most of the New York Review of Books. Lots and lots and lots of things. The trial was the place where we were able to communicate what we did and why we did it. Everybody knew what we had done, but why we did it. This was you were able in this lucky instance to make the courtroom into the theater that it occasionally becomes. Moral theater, theater of values. Well, of course, we expected to go to prison. We expected to go to prison for a great many years. We were very, very lucky that the judge sentenced us to prison for only 2 years. We were assuming that something in the order of a 10-year sentence, which when I think about it would have been pretty... I don't know what I would have done. It was a pretty long piece of my life. We were just, I suppose, a little bit crazy to think about we could do that. But as I say, we were lucky. It was only 2 years.
What were they like, those 2 years?
Well, I think for each of the people in the group, they probably have quite a different response. For me, again, I'd have to say it was one of the better periods of my life. I think for some of the others, it might be at the absolute opposite end of the spectrum. Nobody was injured or abused in any way in our group. There's no horror stories that I'm aware of. I was once hit by another prisoner, but he ended up becoming a friend of mine before too long. He just assumed that because I was white and he was Indian that I was probably a racist, and something I'd said had gotten his dander up and he struck me. That was the only incident that I had. Somebody was very eager to have a sexual relationship with me, but he wasn't a rapist, and I managed to get through that without any harm being done to me or to him.
Did you go into prison with a reputation through being part of
this? Oh, they knew that I was... I had somebody working in the front office of the prison who told me that they had had telegrams from the state prison authorities in Madison to be very careful of this prisoner because he was a writer and a journalist. You know. So they were well aware of. We were notorious. We were famous people. Although I was myself not particularly famous, it was just anybody who was in this group was one of the Milwaukee 14, you see. So they were painfully aware of who we were and handling us with kid gloves, you could say.
You were saying earlier, Jim, that this was rather out of character for you, you know, to have to take an action like that. You weren't completely sort of enthusiastic about it.
Well, I was enthusiastic about it. Because I suppose it met a need of mine. I had to suppress something in myself and give space. I was so desperately concerned to do something more than just counsel young people. But many of them were going to prison, you see. I wasn't going to prison. I'd been in the military. I had no service obligation. None of us did. Most of us were either veterans or priests who were automatically excused. And I think many people who were in this category, who'd had no danger of being drafted into the war, but who were wholeheartedly concerned with bringing it to an end, were frustrated that there was so little we could do that would really matter, or where we would have to pay the kind of price that was being paid by anybody who was sent into the armed forces or sent to prison. I mean, it wasn't just that we were thinking about the young people who were going to prison in America because they refused to take part. We were also thinking about the young people who went into the army because they didn't dare not go into the army. And what price were they being made to pay? They were being taken away from their families. They were being put in a place that they never wanted to go, to do things that they never wanted to do, possibly to be killed, even more likely to be injured, possibly damaged for life, perhaps have mental illness for the rest of their life, who knows what other things. And God only knows what they would have to remember having done when they were there. So we thought, we need to do something where we show that even people who are themselves, quote, safe from the war, are willing to go to prison. And what would be, it should be something that dramatizes our concern that nobody should be forced into the armed forces to fight in this war. So this seemed to be a reasonable thing to do. We thought, as an analogy, that it would have been a wonderful thing if throughout occupied countries any records that identified people as Jews had been destroyed, you see, and that the Nazis couldn't possibly just go into a file cabinet and decide who to send to a concentration camp. It was that kind of analogy that we were thinking of. It would have been a wonderful thing if the tracks that carried people to the death camps could have been taken apart time and again or bombed. You know, some way that anything could have been done to make this killing of people, this methodical killing, more difficult, should have been done. And here we are in a situation where we ought to be doing this ourselves in our own society here and now.
But was it also a way of bearing witness for someone like yourself?
Oh, yes. We were certainly bearing witness. And I know that we it very deeply touched a lot of people. And yet, I mean, when I say I had to repress something in myself, it is this very, very ambiguous feelings that I've always had about protest. I'm not a person who likes to protest. It just is. I don't like to be in crowds. I don't like to be part of some river of humanity marching in this direction or that. I don't like mob mentalities of any kind, no matter what they're shouting for. It always frightens me when I see anybody, any group of people taking up a common shout for anything whatsoever. You know, it could be something I agree with wholeheartedly, and I still tend to go in the opposite direction. So to be part of a protest is always something where I have to really feel it. It's an obligation. It's a penitential thing. I think that you have to. I guess that's probably the way to look at it. But I don't know if I would have seen it at that time in quite that light. But it was certainly a penitential action. I mean, I knew for sure I'd be going to prison. I didn't want to go to prison. I had no desire to be in prison. I wasn't appealing to me, to put it mildly. But it seemed to me a very small thing compared to what any soldier had to do.
Can you think of any other sort of formative influences?
We've mentioned briefly Dorothy Day. I haven't said very much about her. Certainly she was one of the great influences. Thich Nhat Hanh is another. We've talked about Nhat Hanh quite a bit. Certainly the other, and perhaps in many ways most important influence of all, is Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk living in a monastery in Kentucky, born at the very beginning of World War I in the south of France, educated mostly in England, went to America, convert to Catholicism, ended up as a monk. His autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, became famous throughout the world and is still very widely read. He was in correspondence with Dorothy Day. And when I came to the Catholic Worker, just to visit, I can remember Dorothy reading aloud at the table one day a letter from Merton, and I was quite amazed that a Trappist monk who presumably could maintain very little contact with even family members was in correspondence with Dorothy, and that a woman who represented Christian engagement in the world should be very much in touch with somebody who, in the comic book way of looking at the world, would be seen as absolutely the opposite, somebody who had left the world, slammed the door, and never planned to open it again. And here it was quite surprising. Also, he was certainly the most famous Catholic writer alive, at least in the United States at the time. Dorothy knew either already or soon after my special interest in monasticism, that she knew my appreciation of Merton's autobiography, which I've read. Somehow or other, she encouraged me to start writing to him, which I don't think I would have done had it not been for that advice or that encouragement. She might have even given me a letter, I think she did, saying, "Why don't you answer this letter?" And I was absolutely staggered. It would be like getting a letter from Winston Churchill, you know. You received this letter, you are some very important person, you were the head of some department of the government, giving it to some kid who just came in and is working downstairs someplace. And would you answer this? You see, something like that. Kids are usually up to these things. They think they can do anything. They think they could be prime minister better than the prime minister. If it's no problem at all. Just show me where the desk is. So I was ready to write to Merton. And it was the beginning of what I didn't know until some years ago, long after he was dead, was one of the largest sets of letters he wrote to anybody. We corresponded for what turned out to be the last 7 years of his life at quite a pace. And there's a collection of Merton's letters to various people, in which 50 pages of the book are just letters, some of the letters he wrote to me. So, you know, actually, that's not the whole of it, though that certainly is most of it. Visited him a couple of times. But I'd have to say one of the interesting things when recalling a friendship of this type, that I was quite a young person again, I was in my 20s. Burton was born in 1919. I was born in 1941. There's a big age difference, to say the least. He's what he had to say to me while he was alive was probably more listened to me after he died. I'm sure I got something out of it while the letters were fresh out of the post, but the significance of that relationship continues to unfold, you see. And I'm sure that I understand far more of what he was trying to say to me now than I did at that time. And perhaps in another 10 years I'll have a little bit more of it. So,
What do you think you've gained up until now, your understanding?
From Merton? Well, of course, the first thing, I suppose, is just that a deeper sense of the mercy of God. Merton, in one of his more particularly famous books, The Sign of Jonas, uses a phrase about God, which is mercy within mercy within mercy. I think a young person can't possibly understand the significance of that way of speaking about God. We don't know that we even need the mercy of God, not to mention the mercy within mercy within mercy. We may know it to a very slight extent. I don't mean to say we're totally unaware of the problems in our lives and so forth, but as you get older, I think inevitably you become very much aware of your need for the mercy of God. And Merton was able to communicate through his friendship, through his advice, through his letters, through his books, I think implicit in almost everything he wrote and did was this tremendous sense of the mercy of God. And then, of course, the struggle that he engaged in, largely through correspondence, but occasionally through face-to-face contact, for the peace movement not to become self-righteous. Think of the story of that Christ tells of the publican and the Pharisee in the temple praying, and the Pharisee's rather a good man, really. He's very generous with his money, gives it away to the things that would be appropriate to give it to, and he obeys the laws and so forth. Unfortunately, he's all too aware of this, reminding God what an outstanding and upright man he is. Well, the poor publican in the back, who really is a great sinner, is overcome by his awareness of that condition and begs, and doesn't even dare to look toward the Torah scrolls in the front of the synagogue, just beating his breast, and, "Lord, have mercy on me." The peace movement, of course, can very easily be the Pharisee. We can be very aware of what moral people we are, what excellent things we're doing, that we stand for human life and we stand for decency and whatever you want you to. Well, there's soldiers and government officials and factory executives and so forth are dreadful people, terrible sinners, doing awful things, profiting from human suffering, grinding the bones of the poor, whatever we want to say. We can look down our noses from quite an altitude. Merton was, of course, quite aware of this. He'd been a student at Columbia during the days leading up to the Second World War. He'd been part of various radical groups. They knew the mentality from the inside. He'd once considered himself something of a communist in his days as a student at Clare and in his first months at Columbia University in New York City. They knew the way that people in movements can think and how they can can pronounce the most peaceful words with the most deadly glares, you see. So if you look at the letters that Merton wrote, to me, for example, but also to others, it's a theme that he picks up on again and again, the compassion that you must have toward those who you perceive as adversaries and who may, objectively speaking, be doing things which are quite awful. but who probably, or at least one must assume, doing it with the best of intentions, who think that there may be nothing other that they can do, however awful it may be, in order to protect the values of the nation or whatever. So this compassion that should be at the center of social action was a big theme to Merton. And the spiritual life, just that we have to be living a spiritual life.
Does that tie in with the attitudes of the peace movement towards the military, do you think?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. The typical chant that would be recited by the pious pacifists outside the White House during the Johnson years was, LBJ, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? Probably I've said it. I don't remember. I hope not, but probably I did. Certainly I took part in all sorts of demonstrations. And you know, that's what I was talking about, this mob mentality. When you're in a crowd, there's always the danger that you will participate in a mind which is not your own, and which is nobody's mind, that just sweeps you along like a tidal force. It's very difficult. And you can easily end up, if you get into certain circumstances, raising your hand in a Hitler salute if you're in the right place in the right year, or saying, LBJ, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? Same person could do both of these things in the same degree of wholeheartedness and no-heartedness. So we did have these attitudes of addressing people in the government and in the armed forces as if they were wicked people. That very often happened. I hope it didn't happen to me very much, because at least I had the benefit of having been in the military, which wasn't usual. So I knew that they were human beings. They weren't just uniforms walking around by themselves. You know? I was, thank God for that. But there's always the temptation. It's always a struggle when you know what harm is being done, what the things that these people are doing result in human terms. It's very difficult sometimes not to be swept away by anger and the experience very much the potential violence within yourself.
The fact that you were in the Navy, part of the military, that seems to be important for your understanding and the work you do.
Yes,
now.
It was certainly a grace in my life. I'm so happy that I was in the military. Happy not only because it helps me to look on those who are in the military service with a sense of personal identification, but it was just, in many ways, it was a very positive experience, quite apart from things that I've done later in my life. It was while I was in the Navy that I became a Christian. There were people in the Navy who helped me in that direction. I learned something of my own capacity for science, which I never knew about before. I never had intended to study meteorology, you can be assured. And haven't gone very far with it since, but still it revealed something of myself. I was taken to interesting places. You know, there were so many good things about it. Perhaps it helped me develop a certain discipline in my life, which God knows the peace movement might not do. You know, we have lots and lots of people in the peace movement who have no more discipline than, Jell-O. It's just on a warm stove. So there are many things about that which I wish we had in the peace movement. I wish we had something in the world, some structure of service that people, young people, could be a part of as a normal growing up experience that would give them some of the positive things that the military offers, to do something positive for other people in the world, and that would be a routine part of growing up. Oh, I think that would be grand. So I'd be all for it. Mm. And maybe not the draft, but something awfully close to it. This would be just plain normal, like going to school. You do it.
So you're not saying bring back national service as such, but something.
Yes, well, maybe we could just say a 1 year of school will be a year of service. Something like that. If we can put it under the heading that it'll be part of your education. An education is not complete without a year of service. So we're going to do something in the world that will be of use to other people, you know, in a Maybe you could work a little bit of an educational dimension into it so it can be continue to be more or less disguised as education. Not tell people this is the draft or something like that. Then they'll want to resist, of course. But there are not too many draft resistors to school. So I would like that. Because we need to have a transitional experience between leaving home and going into the world. The military is really the only structure that offers that at the moment that I know of. There are a few small volunteer organizations, Brethren Volunteer Service. One could make a list of them. But it's a 1 out of 1,000, 1 out of 10,000 kids who even know they exist.
Could I ask you now about Holland, you know, your work in Holland? What was it that took you over to Holland?
Well, after I got out of prison, I worked for a while for, I was a member of a community called Emmaus House in East Harlem. While I was there, I was invited to go to Paris to take part in a meeting. Went. Thich Nhat Hanh was my host when I was in Paris. It wasn't a meeting that he had organized, but he was living in Paris at the time, so I stayed with him. This experience renewed my feeling that the American peace movement is a very parochial peace movement, probably still is. It certainly is. We're talking now about 20 years ago. That we ought to be much more engaged in international structures of peacemaking than we are. I.e., for example, I ought to be. How's that for a starter? And I think from it happened slowly, but going on over several years, rejoining the FOR staff, editing the Fellowship magazine published by the American FOR, my work bringing me back again and again, and not just my work, but my personal interests, my holidays and so forth, to come to Europe, to always to see Nhat Hanh, to visit with friends and relatives in Europe, feeling more and more that I should really, if the chance comes, seize it. Then the International Fellowship for Reconciliation was in rather a bad state. It troubled me very much that it wasn't able to do its work very effectively. Its magazine was something that only, who knows who would read it, certainly not anybody that I could think of. I was the editor of a magazine which potentially might use some of its material. I never found anything in it to use. I could hardly stand to read it. And the organization was internally very unhappy, very divided. The staff was unhappy. The place they were working was not a very suitable place. Brussels at the time was, I don't know how it is now, but it's not a place I'd want anybody to live in that I care for. It's not a city that has a very good spirit to it, I don't think. In any event, when they decided to look for a new, as it was called at the time, coordinator, and to restructure the staff and possibly to move and so forth. Well, actually, I'd been one of the people to develop a series of ideas about how the IFOR might restructure itself. And when the ideas were accepted in principle and they began looking for a coordinator, I applied for the job and got it. So on the 1st of January, 1977, my former wife, Laura, our two children, very small children, Daniel and Wendy, got off the plane in Amsterdam. And I've been in Holland ever since. And I think, what was it, about 12 years, the first 12 years were heading the IFOR staff.
How did you restructure it? Do you know, what was it you did?
Well, there were several things. One was simply to move it. That was partly just to shake the dust out of, and to get it into a living environment where the staff would more likely feel renewed. Because it is training. Peace work is not work I'd recommend to very many people. I wouldn't recommend prison to many people, and I would even less recommend peace work to most people as a full-time employment. People who are attracted to peace work are very often quite contentious people, ready to argue about things at the drop of a hat. It can be pretty bloody-minded. The peace movement is certainly a funny way of describing it. I found much, much better social relations in the military than I've usually found in the peace movement. I wouldn't say there's a big difference, but.
Is there a movement?
Yes. Well, there's not a real. I mean, I think that word suggests something much more homogenous than exists. There are a flotilla of groups that are sailing sometimes more or less in the same direction and sometimes not. They're certainly very aware, each group is aware of its own unique identity, of course, and has its positive and sometimes negative aspects. I was concerned that the IFOR should be in a place where the staff could be more at home, where there would be local people who would take an interest and would invite them into their homes, which was not happening in Brussels, where they were in a society that would perhaps be, as a whole, much more sympathetic to the kinds of things that the IFOR was working for.